Okay, I want to welcome everybody, and thank you for coming to the symposium on multi-level brain modeling. Before we begin our symposium, we have a list of sponsors and some very important announcements to make. So you'll notice that the list of sponsors here is inverted, like an inverted, like just a little bit like our library, which is located right here. We're at the University of California in San Diego, and I want to acknowledge support for allowing us to use this wonderful auditorium and to organize a webcast that's going on simultaneously to some of our sister institutions, and in particular to Ramesh Rao, who's the director of the UCSD California Institute of Telecommunications and Information Technology. The symposium today is really the first chapter of a workshop that will continue on through the weekend, which is being organized by the Schwartz Foundation, and we're very fortunate that Jerry Schwartz is here today, and we're very, very thankful for his support. The Science Network is a new channel that is going to be carrying important scientific events like this one, and is sponsoring the webcast. And Roger Bingham, who is here, is the director of the Science Network, and we're very grateful for his efforts to make this possible. And then finally, the Institute for Neural Computation that I direct put efforts into organizing local arrangements. And finally, I'd like to announce publicly for the first time that UCSD has been named as one of the three new NSF-sponsored temporal science of learning centers. And this is a really major coup for UCSD. There were many, many universities that were in the running. And the fact that we came in that top three really speaks very well, not just for the leaders, Gary Cottrell, the PI, Andrea Chiba, the science director, and all the others who were involved in that, but also for our university reaching a point of maturity that can support such a very large center. You'll be hearing more about that in future weeks. This announcement is being made for the first time because NSF wanted to be the first to announce it, and they did that this morning. So our press release is now out on the internet. So, here we have all the different techniques that are used to study the brain. And I have put on this graph here, on the log scale, on the vertical scale, the logarithm of the size of the structure in the brain, ranging from, as you can see down here, micron size up to the whole central nervous system. So this covers eight orders of magnitude, on which scales on which the brain can be studied and understood. But that only tells half the story, because you can also study the brain on many different time scales, and ranging from the millisecond time scale for single spikes, seconds, minutes, hours, days, and extending out to the entire lifetime. The fact that we have memories that can go back to our childhood suggests that there's very long time constants somewhere hidden in our neurons. Now, in order to understand such a very complex system like the brain, we need to have techniques for being able to probe the brain on all of these spatial and temporal timescales. And in 1992, Pat Churchland and I wrote a book entitled The Computational Brain, in which we looked at all the techniques that were at the time being used, for example, the single unit technique that allowed single neurons in the cortex to be recorded single spikes all the way to experiments that lasted for many hours and days, but over a very narrow range of the brain, just one neuron out of hundreds of billions of neurons. There's optical dyes that could extend over a much wider range of spatial scales, but very relatively limited in other respects. PET at the time was the leading imaging technique, and you'll notice there's a big hole here, And in fact, if I had a dime for every time I've seen this slide appear in someone's talk or book chapter with their favorite technique put in, pasted in as a useful addition, I think I'd be wealthy now. This particular hole was very inviting because it's being filled right now by functional magnetic resonance imaging, a very powerful technique that has a time scale on the order of seconds, but allows recordings to be made from nearly the entire brain at the resolution of about a millimeter. So this region right here. But there's another reason for putting this slide up, and it has to do with theoretical conceptual framework. It's clear that neuroscientists collecting data in all these different places publish in different journals. They have different language that they use to describe their results. They interpret them differently, even when they're studying the very same brain region. Why is that? Well, it's because, as you can see, often it's not overlapping. It's not clear, for example, how you relate the EEG and MEG to the functional magnetic resonance imaging signals. It's a very interesting question. And it can be asked on many levels, ranging from how does the single unit reflect the signals that are seen, for example, within the EEG, or event-related potentials. These are really important issues that have been neglected, but I think now it's ripe for us to begin to think of how to bridge these different levels. And there's another way that can be bridged too, and that is through trying to understand the brain as a self-organized system. It's clear that all these levels communicate on all these different timescales, and the single neurons communicate to networks, and networks communicate to maps, and up and down. And how is that information flow? How does behavior arise from that flow? At what levels are the computations being done that are involved, for example, in my coming up here and giving this lecture? It's probably all these levels, and it's probably integrated across many different timescales. So one of the themes, major themes, in our Science of Learning Center, in fact, is to try to study these different timescales in the context of education. Children hear sounds, speech, and that is occurring here at the millisecond level in terms of the information content. But that then affects how the auditory cortex interprets those sounds in terms of words, and how the words are interpreted in terms of meaning. And how is that meaning remembered? Well, memory is clearly something that's going to be very important to study at all of these levels, and it's something that our first speaker is going to tell us about. The speakers that we've lined up for this afternoon are all experts in their fields. And we're going to have two talks before the break. Larry Abbott first is going to be talking about multiple timescales. Quabena Bowen about ways of scaling up models of the cortex in real time. And then we'll take a break and we'll have two additional speakers. Michael Breakspear from the University of New South Wales and Bob Knight from Berkeley. Now, we are living through an era which is going to be remembered in history as the time when, for the first time, humans understood their own brains. I remember growing up when I was in college during an era when humans, for the first time, got to see the solar system because of the Voyager and the explorers and all of the probes that NASA sent out. We didn't know what the moons of Mars looked like until we sent cameras out there. Before that, you can only imagine it. After they went out, it's pictures in the textbooks. Well, we're doing the research now that will be the pictures in the textbooks 100 years from now. And you can only discover things for the first time once. That's what makes this such an exciting era, that we're all engaged in this process of trying to understand, put the pieces together and understand how the whole system works. And so that's what the symposium is going to be about. Larry Abbott from Columbia University started out life as a physicist, and he still is. Recently, he was in the news because a paper he had published several decades ago has surfaced when he was a relativistic astrophysicist. The paper has surfaced as the leading explanation for the expanding universe. It was called back then the cosmological constant. Now it's called dark energy. But it's wonderful to have such a delayed gratification. Now that Larry has switched fields to neuroscience and has become one of the leading theoreticians in our field. So I'll turn the podium over to Larry, who's going to tell us about multiple timescale of neuronal information processing.
Okay, thank you, Terry. Get rid of this. So I want to congratulate everybody here about this great grant thing that happened. And you know, I didn't know this was going to be announced, but actually my talk fits in quite nicely with this theme of timescales of dynamics in learning. It's actually kind of what I'm talking about. So maybe you should give me a couple of million. So I want to talk about the difference, you know, a striking difference between mechanical systems and living systems. If I were to take a piece of steel up here or something and bend it and let go, it would sprung for a little while. But within a couple of seconds, the whole thing would be over. There would be no evidence in that steel that I had bent it. But if you bend a person, as you've probably all experienced, it lasts a lot longer and has a much more complicated effects. So I want to imagine a little story for you, just to get the dramatic aspect of this in here. And that is that imagine, you know, that we're sitting in this room and a little fire breaks out over there in the corner, okay? I've depicted this in a sort of a random slide here. I thought I'd get a bigger laugh when I put it on. Okay, so imagine a little fire breaks out in the corner, okay? So, you know, we would perceive it with less than 100 milliseconds. Our visual system would see the flames and all that. And I would think, you know, within a second or so, we'd all realize this is danger, it's a fire, we're going to have to do something. And, you know, in my picture, Terry, being a great guy, jumps up within, you know, 10 seconds or something and courageously goes over and he puts out the fire, okay? And we live. Yeah, you weren't supposed to laugh at that. That's the realistic part. Okay, so we've already seen, you know, that this event, this flash event that we perceive within 100 milliseconds is causing reactions. But, you know, we're all going to be buzzing about it for the next few minutes. And in fact, the emotions of that will go around for hours in us. It would probably be a long time before we all calm down about it. And you know, even for days, we'd sort of have the emotions of that event. And then, of course, from that event, you know, many years later, we'd have me, you know, with my great-grandchildren saying, you know, how I was at UCSD and I courageously jumped up and put up the fire and saved everybody's life. So now, you know, the kids might say, well, wait a minute, I thought Terry leapt up from the audience and he actually saved the day. And I would say, no, you can see that Terry was the speaker, so he couldn't have done it, I must have done it. Anyway, the point here is not just to make fun, but that it's amazing that a little flame over there would generate with us things that would never change for the rest of our life. Something, event like that, I doubt if any of us would forget. And yet, in addition, we'd have very quick perceptions. So that's what I want to talk about. I want to give you an example of that to start off. I should keep track of where I started. A simple example, I mean, obviously what I talked about was incredibly complex, but this is a very nice result from the Nelson Lab on electric fish. It doesn't really matter what's going on here. It's a very simple experiment, or what the prep is, in which a stimulus is basically turned on, and you're looking at the firing rate of a neuron that detects electric fields in the electric fish as a function of time while that stimulus is just left turned on at a constant amplitude. And what you see here is what many, many sensory neurons do. Nothing surprising. It adapts. You start off with a high firing rate initially, and it adapts out. Okay. And if I showed you this picture, you'd say, well, why is he showing me this? This is just classic adaptation. But what this group did was to rebin their data. First of all, they left the stimulus on, and then rebin their data over a 10-second period. And you see that it looks just the same, that this plateau was actually an illusion, and the adaptation just keeps right on going. And then they did the same thing and rebend their data over a 100-second period, and the adaptation just keeps right on going. So the fact that here you might say, well, we have perhaps 100 millisecond time constant of adaptation is an illusion, because if you looked at this picture, you might say, well, we have a 1-second time constant of adaptation. And if you looked at this picture, you might say there's a 10-second adaptation time constant. And so what they argued in that paper was that adaptation was actually taking place over many, many time scales, kind of like my first Terry takeoff slide. So this is something I think it's important for us to start thinking about. I'll give you one more example that's relevant to my talk. These are forgetting curves. Forgetting curves for people who have memorized word lists and for pigeons who learned some kind of pecking task, which target to peck. And the point is that these tuning curves are not exponential. They're not single time constant processes, but power law. Now, the significance of that, I think you all know from your own experience. In other words, I could not tell you that you're going to forget my lecture in 3.7 days, right? Because there's no typical time scale. What's going to happen, of course, you will forget my lecture, but bits and pieces of it will last a long time. Some of it will go away quickly. And there's no guaranteed time constant. And that's typical of a power law. Power law is a curve that doesn't have any typical time scale. You just forget. And you can't, like you could with an exponential, say, you know, in three time constants, it's all gone. Little bits of it remain in the tails of these curves. So memory is one of these multi-scale phenomena, and my slide at the beginning should have sort of alerted you to that. Now, the problem is, in either theoretical work or experimental work, actually, but I'll talk about theoretical work, is that we resist this this multi-time scale nature of many of these biological processes. And we tend to focus on sort of one scale, and often that scale is very fast. So we know a lot about synapses and neurons that work even at a finer scale, you know, milliseconds, tens of milliseconds. We know lots about those sorts of processes. Of course, they're easier to study in a lab. If you want to do an experiment, it's nice to have something quick so you can measure it and go home. But we tend to just sort of ignore all this stuff and focus on here. Often we try to explain things up here using only these processes. So I want to just raise the question of whether we can do better than that. It's hard, and I think really it isn't an exaggeration to say the challenge of applying mathematics to living things is really this. It's that living things have these huge range of time scales, and mathematically that's extraordinarily difficult to deal with. Okay, so I want to give you a couple of examples of stuff that we've done. This is an example from Patrick Drew, who I think you're here, right? He's here. He's another guy who would have gone over and extinguished the fire if Terry didn't get there first. So this is work of Patrick Drew's when he was a graduate student with me, where we at least have a couple of scales interacting and see what happens. And what we were imagining, I'll show it to you in a second, was that we had synaptic plasticity, which is a process in its induction that occurs on the tens of milliseconds sort of scale, sub 100 millisecond scale. And we wanted to link that with a slower process for reasons I'll explain in a second. So we wanted to link it to persistent activity that might last for tens of seconds or even minutes, and also some sort of slow adaptation processes or slow changes in firing rate, like the ones that I just showed you. And the question is, what do you get by linking these that you wouldn't have gotten by ignoring this and kind of doing business as usual? All right, well, the data we were trying to explain is this very nice experiment from the Heisenberg lab, which was done on flies. It's a very, very simple experiment, classical conditioning experiment. The flies were put into a T-shaped tube, and an odor was presented to them, at least for the data points on the left, which I will start with. An odor was presented to them from one of the sides, from either their left side or their right side, followed by a shock. And, of course, over trials, as in classical conditioning, the flies associated that odor with a shock. And therefore, when they were tested later, and you're seeing the results of that test, they avoided the odor. And this learning index is an indication of how often they ran away from the odor relative to how often they ran towards the odor. So, in other words, these points are showing you something you all know, that a stimulus tied to an aversive reaction, a shock, is going to be interpreted as something to avoid. They did an interesting thing on the other side here, though, which is to reverse the order. In other words, shock the animal and then present them with the stimulus. And that actually caused a little bit of an attraction to the this odor, as if it was sort of the odor reminding, well, the shock's, you know, is done now, so it must be good. So they got this interesting curve and remarked on its remarkable resemblance to a curve, and I'm going to use an example measured by another person here, Dan Feldman, a curve that's synaptic in origin. So this is a curve of the plasticity in a synapse in the cortex as a function of the time difference between pre- and postsynaptic stimulation. Okay? And you can see it looks a lot the same. And in fact, in this paper, it was remarked that it looks a lot the same. But if you read the scales, you'll also see that there's a problem in just matching up these two phenomena. There's a gigantic change of scale of 1,000. This scale is milliseconds. This scale is seconds. So it would be nice to try to think of this curve as somehow being associated with this phenomena. In other words, here you're seeing when a presynaptic stimulus comes before a postsynaptic stimulus, you get a potentiation of the synapse, and when the order is reversed, you get a depression of the synapse. You know, that it kind of begs to be linked to this phenomenon, and it has the property of classical conditioning that causality is extremely important. That's really what you're seeing in both of these curves, is that the order has a huge effect on the behavior, and the order has a huge effect on the synapse. But there's an impediment there, and that is that you've got to leap over a factor of 1,000 in time scale. So this is the classic kind of thing that we have to do in the temporal dynamics of learning, actually. Okay, so what do we do about this? This is a really simple model, just to get the idea across of how you might leap over these two time scales. We imagine that we just have a pair of neurons, or if you want, two populations of neurons connected by a bunch of synapses. The presynaptic neurons here respond to the odor, and the postsynaptic neurons respond to the shock initially. And we want to know if by pairing the odor and the shock, we can potentiate a pathway so that this postsynaptic neuron starts responding to the odor. That's classical conditioning. And then we want to know if you can get sensitivity of this process to the presentation order of the odor and the shock. Even though, and we're going to put spike timing dependent plasticity there at that synapse. And you might say, well, okay, you got it, because now you have a temporal dependence on the synapse. But again, this one's on the order of tens of milliseconds, whereas this order is going to be changed on the order of tens of seconds. So we have this huge factor discrepancy. Okay, so what's the trick? First of all, you've got to make sure that these two neurons are firing at the same time, even if the odor and the shock are separated by a long period of time. Otherwise, there's no trace of the odor left in the system. And we imagine that happened in the following way. Imagine that you present the odor, and this presynaptic neuron is sensitive to the odor. It starts firing, and then after the odor presentation is done, it remains firing but decays very slowly away. So that's the memory trace of the odor, if you want, and it's a decaying memory trace. Now, when the shock comes along, this postsynaptic neuron fires, and we actually imagine that it may also have a long tail, which is the memory of the shock, if you want, and then very, very slowly decays away. The question is, combining the fast process of synaptic plasticity with this slow decay, can you bridge the gap in these timescales? Okay, well, I'll just remind you quickly about spike timing plasticity. The idea is that when you have pairs of spikes paired with the presynaptic going before the postsynaptic, you get potentiation. And this curve characterizes how much potentiation you get as a function of the time difference between those spikes, where this side represents the pre-before-post side. And this red curve represents the amount of depression you would get if you paired spikes in the opposite order so that the postsynaptic spike preceded the presynaptic spike. Now, if you want to know what happens over multiple trials, and that's what we're imagining here, we're imagining that fly is presented with the odor and the shock several times at least, and that many spikes would be generated during those trials, you've got to sum up the effects of more than one pair, and we imagine we can do that just by summing up the effects that we would get off of this graph. So in other words, if you had one spike pair with this separation, you'd read off that change, and ones with this separation, you'd add that change with this separation, and one with this separation, you'd subtract off that change. You just add it up, and you'd see what the total effect is. And this has has the impact that the relevant quantity here, in order to figure out what's going to happen with spike timing dependent plasticity, is the correlation function between the pre and postsynaptic neuron. That's what I've shown here. In other words, how often does the presynaptic neuron fire, 5 milliseconds before the post, 10 milliseconds before, 15, or equivalently, how often does it fire 5 milliseconds after, et cetera? And you're going to get some kind of histogram that looks like this. Then in order to figure out what happens, all you have to do is to overlay this spike timing dependent plasticity curve on top of this histogram and integrate. Because what you're doing is you're adding up the effect of all of those spike pairs and those and those and those, and you're subtracting out all of those, and you'll get a good estimate of the total effect of this activity on the synapse. So that's what we want to do here. And the nice observation that Patrick made was that when you have a situation like this, where you have, we're talking about this region here, when the cells are simultaneously firing, when you have a slowly decaying firing rate imposed, for example, on this constant firing rate, it doesn't really matter whether you put that in or not, you automatically get a correlation function that is not symmetric, and that's what we need. I should have pointed that out. What we need to get, let's say, potentiation of the synapse is more stuff over here than over here, because we want lots of spike pairs in the potentiation side of the curve. And similarly, if we want to have depression of the synapse, we want to have more action over here than over here, not the case I've drawn. I've drawn a case where there's more action on the left side, obviously. Okay, and what Patrick observed then was that the correlations were asymmetric in this critical region of sort of tens of milliseconds where spike time independent plasticity acts, and that the slope of this curve depended on the temporal ordering of whether the odor became before the shock or the odor came after the shock. So it has all the properties we need to get an effect on the plasticity of the synapse, even though the synaptic plasticity is only operating in this tiny little window. And indeed, these figures show that it can work. So the idea here is that these plots are showing you the activity of this postsynaptic neuron, one of a family of these postsynaptic neurons. And these histograms are showing you the histograms of strength of these synapses. It's only one synapse in the diagram, but there are many in the model. So this is a histogram of their strength. Now, initially, this is at the beginning of the process. This neuron, as I told you, responds to the shock but not to the odor, and that's what you're seeing here. The odor presentation is here, the shock is here, and you get a nice robust response of the postsynaptic neuron to the shock. But then you do that for something like 20 trials, and you can see that these synapses are starting to get stronger. This is strength here and a frequency of occurrence. And that's causing now here a sub-threshold response to the odor. Even though these odor and shock are separated by many seconds, several seconds in this case, you can look at the time scales, maybe it's 5 or 6 seconds in this case. And this process occurs over tens of milliseconds. The effect that I showed you about, the slow decay, interpolates between them. And then after a sufficient number of trials, sure enough, this neuron starts responding to the odor. Now you can see the temporal dependence of that in this plot, where if you tighten up the spacing between the odor and the shock, you get a much bigger effect. So this is at the end of a number of trials, and now we have a whopping response to the odor. If you separate them by too much for the parameters of this particular curve, if you separate the odor and the shock by 6 seconds, you get a much weaker effect. Here it hasn't even reached a threshold, even after the 40 trials. And more importantly, if you reverse them, so for this bottom plot, you can see here, the shock came first and then the odor, you don't get anything. You don't get any learning because the synapses are trying to get weaker, and we already started out with them small. So in fact, you can calculate this over many, many different time scales, and here's our theoretical curve compared to the original data, and get a pretty good match. Again, the point is that even though this mechanism is based on a 10 millisecond sort of time scale spike timing dependent plasticity, the fact that we had a slow adaptation, a slowly adapting persistent firing rate was enough to bridge those time scales. So that's the spirit of what I want to talk about. All right, I want to give one more example of that that's perhaps a little more ambitious in the sense that we try to stretch up the synaptic plasticity over the whole range here. So I don't know if we get to years, but this is, again, something also done with Patrick and also Stefano Fusi. Trying to build a model in which we considered a range of plasticity at synapses that covered a wide range of scales. So let me show you the model, I guess, and you'll understand better what I'm talking about. So synaptic plasticity is obviously a process by which you change the strength of a synapse. I'm going to talk initially about a simple binary model like this, in which the synapse can exist in either a weak or a strong state. It doesn't really matter, but it makes the discussion easier if we just stick to weak, strong synapses. And, plasticity represents a transition between these. For example, you take a strong synapse and you make it weak as a function of experience. And that would be a typical plasticity model. You'd add, this would be the LTD event, you'd add the LTP event, and you'd be ready to roll. But we decided not to do that because we wanted to get multiple timescales. Now, multiple timescales in this case means multiple levels of plasticity. In other words, we wanted synapses that could be easily changed in their strength and would quickly revert back in the presence of ongoing activity. And we wanted other synapses or other states of the synapse that were more difficult to potentiate and would be much longer lasting. And you'll see why we wanted that in a second. But I think in the spirit of this multi-level, I wanted to show you the model first. So what we added is another dimension to plasticity, something that has been talked about in the literature a lot. It's called metaplasticity. That refers to different states of the synapse, states of the synapse that differ not in their strength. So you see here I've plotted a sequence of states, but they all have the same strength. If you just measured the EPSPs or something corresponding to these states, you get the same answer. What they differ is the property of their plasticity. The states at the top of this cascade are easy to potentiate, or in this case, easy to depress. So all you got to do is pair a couple of spikes and bam, it goes down. And this Q1 refers to the probability of that occurring. So what's the probability that if you pair a few spikes together, you can get the synapse to flip down? And you might think of Q1 as being 1. It's easy to do. But then there are transitions down this chain to states that are much more difficult to depress. So in our case, Q2 here is a half, Q3 is a quarter, Q4 is an eighth, etc. So these get much more stiff and much more long-lasting as a result as you go down in an exponential manner. So they kind of look like the Terry plot at the beginning, where you have this exponential cascade of time scales going down here. And obviously, it should occur to you, what we're trying to do here is have states that are good at learning, easy to make transitions, and states that are good at remembering. And that's sort of the theme that will come up. It's a long-lasting theme in the memory literature. So we build a structure like this, and the key is that you can make transitions down the chain. So, for example, let me put in the other side. We also make the chain symmetric, just to make it simple. For example, if you started with a synapse in this weak state, you could potentiate it. But then if you tried to potentiate it again, you can't get any stronger. It's already saturated. What you would do is start going down this way. And again, these P's are the probabilities of making these transitions, and they go down as well in the same geometric cascade. So it's very hard to make this transition, but once you've made it, you've built a synapse that's going to live there for a long time. Okay, so I would not claim that this pretty picture with the nice colors and the symmetry is the actual state diagram of a synapse, but But I think it captures the spirit of what's going on in synapses. People, for example, Montgomery and Madison is a nice example, have started to plot diagrams like this of synapses. And I think we need a lot more research to fill it out. But I think the true state diagram of a synapse is going to have this basic feature. It's not going to look like this, of course, but it's going to have these basic features.
So the longest living memories are at the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you put the smallest at the bottom, so I had to put the shortest at the bottom, but I like to put the smallest at the top. Okay. All right, so how do we do this this calculation? I want to imagine, you know, I can monitor a synapse in your head as you go through your day, right? And I'm predicting that what I would see would be this. I'm looking at the strength of a synapse somewhere in your head, and I'll start off at 100% when you woke up this morning. It's going to look like, I would guess, like a random walk. Sometimes it'll get stronger, sometimes it'll get weaker, and it's hard to know what the time scale for this, but I would guess 10 seconds or something, maybe a minute. On that order, it seems fairly likely, of course nobody knows this, but that at least in some regions of your brain, synapses are flipping back and forth. So there's, you know, there it's only 1 second of your day, but there's a second of your day. Now, somewhere embedded in there is perhaps the memory of an experience, okay? Something that happened to you this morning that you happen to remember. And the way we monitor that is to imagine that this synapse may have been part of the memory of that experience, but it's kind of hard to see, you know, exactly which event occurred. But if I could go into your brain and I could find all of the synapses that were potentiated by that experience, potentiated by the fact that maybe, you know, an old friend called you this morning or something like that, then I could add up their strength, I'd get something like this, okay? I would see, whoa, something made that particular set of synapses get stronger. From any one synapse's point of view, it's not a big deal. For example, that step might have been this particular synapse's contribution to this memory trace. But if you know where to look, you see a big memory trace. And I want to imagine that I'll go around now looking at all those synapses that recorded your friend's call during the day and watch what happens. That's the idea. And you know, what would happen was that the memory would probably decay away. I'm not talking about fires anymore, things that last for our whole lives, but, you know, relatively inconsequential things that happen to you during the day, and a couple of days later you forget about them. Okay, so what we do is we watch these synapses. Of course, it's a model, it's not your brain, but we watch these synapses, and we record the signal that we get from them, which is basically just the total amount of potentiation that occurred at the beginning, and then as things go on, it decays away. And we also monitor the noise, which is these wiggles caused by the continual potentiation and depression of synapses that's going on in your head by assumption all the time. And from that, we can compute a signal-to-noise ratio, for example. And we use a couple of quantities to characterize how well your memory is working. One is the initial signal-to-noise ratio. So the minute after you learn something, how well is it hammered into your head? And the other is that at some point there's going to be a time when this signal's lost in the noise, when you can't detect it. You have now forgotten that memory. And we call that Tmax. We define it as the time when the signal to noise ratio goes to 1, but it doesn't matter if it's 1, it's some number. And so we use these two quantities to characterize the synapse, the memory, the quality of memory storage, okay? So the question is, why to go to all this trouble of building this complicated model and confusing the daylights out of you with all these colored arrows? Why don't you just do what everybody else does, which is to just take these two states, link them perhaps with a transition with a probability Q, and be done with it? Well, the reason for that is something discovered by Danny Amit and Stefano Fusi quite a while ago, but actually not really acknowledged much by the community. The reason we didn't do this is because it doesn't work worth beans. It works terribly. And let me show you that. Here are plots of this signal-to-noise ratio, which is the memory trace in these models, as a function of time, but time in units of this fundamental transition rate. So R here is how often are our synapses in your brain flipping around, something like maybe 10 seconds if you want to put in a number. And here's the memory traces going away. If you choose a relatively large value of Q, this doesn't seem very large, but it's going to be large for these purposes, What you have, of course, is a system that's very good at learning. We have a very plastic synapse, so it's very easy to flip it and store new memories, but they go away and they decay away exponentially, and they don't last very long. So this is something like 1,000 seconds. That's all you get here. You can improve that memory lifetime by making the synapses stiffer, but you have a trade-off here, which is called the stability-plasticity dilemma by Grossberg, which is that if you're a good rememberer, so this blue curve is much, much better. This is a log-log plot, right? So this is spectacularly good at remembering, but it has a terrible learning ability. So, you know, this is your pig-headed individual who remembers the few facts that he or she knows forever but can't learn anything new. And this is a very flighty individual who can learn lots of things but forgets them. So what we were trying to do, and none of these models even remotely will match what animals or people can do. They're much, much worse. So we were trying to kind of get a model that would not have this dilemma built in. And that's the idea that we were doing here. I'm going to skip this one, actually. That's what we were doing here. We wanted a model in which good learning and good remembering was built into the synapse automatically, and the synapses could distribute themselves as you know, the need arose between being, you know, pig-headed and being flighty. And so what happens if you try that? You get curves that look like this. So these dashed curves are the original ones I showed for different values of this stiffness. And then these are cascades, the solid curves, of different lengths. So this is a 15 metaplasticity cascade, 15 little circles going down the screen, 10 and 15, 5, 10, and 15. I think I said the wrong number. And these dashed curves are then models where the Q value is chosen to be the minimum one in this cascade, so that you can see that these dash curves have quite similar performance as their colored counterparts in the cascade model, but you no longer pay this gigantic price of being pig-headed. So that the blue curve here, for example, stretches out even longer than the dash blue curve. But the cascade model allows it to still be quite a good learner, not as good as the red curve, but you're not paying that big a price. And so I can summarize that with some equations here that I'll just flash up. I'm not going to obviously derive them. But the idea is in these binary models, the traditional memory models, you have this Q parameter, how stiff is the synapse, how easily is it allowed to transition. And you find that the signal-to-noise ratio goes like the square root of the number of synapses. That's great. We have lots of synapses in our head, so we should be able to get gigantic memory signals. But the bad news in that model is that the lifetime of the memory only goes logarithmically in the number of synapses, and that's a complete disaster. Because even if you put every synapse in your brain inside a logarithm, you get a very measly number. So this is the problem. In the cascade model, what you find is that the signal-to-noise ratio is almost as good as it used to be. It just loses by a little logarithmic factor. And the time constant now goes like the square root of the number of synapses. I have a guess. If anybody wants to work on this, I've got a challenge for you. I have a guess that the optimal model that you can build this way would have the signal-to-noise ratio going like the square root of the number of synapses and the lifetime without this log. In other words, we're one log short of the optimal model. So I guess if Terry was doing his 23 questions book now, my conjecture, my Hilbert-like conjecture would be prove that and find a model that does better than ours by a logarithmic factor. But we got pretty close. Among friends, a logarithm is a constant function. Okay, now a nice feature of this model is that it gets the power law forgetting right. So the model that I showed you at the beginning, the binary model, was kind of ruled out because it didn't perform very well, but it also was ruled out because it just didn't match forgetting curves. It had exponential forgetting, where I've shown you that that animals and people have power law forgetting, and in fact, this model also has power law forgetting with a power that actually is pretty close to the pigeons. Okay, I'm going to skip this. All right. I'm going to add something because you might ponder it and because Terry isn't threatening me with time too much. But I'll probably go quickly over this. you might think, I bet I can weasel out of this problem without going to all this elaborate thing of the multi-time scales. In other words, what I'm addressing now is, did I really need to be so complicated with the multiple time scales and everything? And the answer is, I think so. But I want to lay your mind to rest about a couple of things. One thing that people often will think of is that, you know, we have this binary synapse model. What if you had the synapse going between, you know, two limits, but you allowed it to take many, many steps in between, not just one step? Won't you do better? And in fact, intuitively, if you think about it a little bit, you would think you'd do a lot better. So we're going to look at the possibility. This is more recent work with Stefano, where we have a step size alpha. So each LTP event, for example, would only move you alpha to the right. It might, you know, might take 100 steps to get all the way from the weakest synapse to the strongest synapse. So what about taking little steps? Wouldn't that help? Now, the reason your intuition, if you've intuited this, is right, is shown in this black curve. So here is actually 1 over alpha. So this means the number of steps rather than the step size. It's a little easier to interpret. So here it takes 150 steps to get from the weakest bound to the strongest bound. And this black curve would indicate that, wow, you can really improve things this way. The problem is that this black curve only applies if you balance potentiation and depression very accurately. In other words, as you go through your day, we would have to demand that you have equal numbers of potentiation and depression events. And if we throw that balance off, even by, let's say, 10%, then you get this red curve, in which case this doesn't help at all. So it's not so easy to fix it that way. Another thing that people often say is, well, what if you soften up these boundaries or somehow? You just, you know, you don't make it go wham, wham between states, but it kind of drifts against a soft boundary. Just to show you quickly, you can get an improvement there by taking small steps if you have soft boundary conditions, but it's only a linear improvement. So it's not enough, really, to compensate for this logarithmic disaster. So the answer is, I don't think you can get around. The answer is twice thing. I guarantee you this model isn't right. But I feel strongly that you have to incorporate these multi-time scales of the dynamics of learning, just what, you know, you got $20 million to do it, you ought to be able to do it. Then you're going to have to get that to get this right. Okay, so I just wanted to conclude then with some of the features of this model. The principle of this cascade model is you have states with high plasticity for quick learning and states with low plasticity for retention, and you must have those over a very large time range in order to match even modestly human and animal data. And we get that big range because we have exponentially decreasing cues here, so we get a really large range. Okay. Now, you might argue that I've sort of done the memory for non-unique experiences, things that you forget. But what about that fire? What would have happened during the fire? How could you get single trial learning in a model like this? I would predict the following. Let's say the fire breaks out and we have synapses that go from weak to strong. But then we get terrified, okay? We're scared. And the idea would be that perhaps that terror induces a modulator that facilitates these transitions. So instead of slowly going down here with low probability, you just go wham down to there with unit probability, because these processes have been facilitated by the emotion of the event, and then all of a sudden it's locked in. So it's easy in this model to get single trial learning if you're willing to modulate those P's that I have up there. The other thing that's interesting, and I'll show you one slide on that before I quit, is that this model, as you see, had the dynamics of forgetting in it. It matched forgetting curves. But it also had the potential to have the dynamics of learning. And learning dynamics, I guess that's what you're here to study with this grant, is interesting. One of the classic ones is the spaced mast effect, which is your teacher telling you, don't just cram for the exam the night before. Actually, you know, study the course while we're doing it. And that's a universal effect in training of animals, any kind of animal, that animals do better, or people with spaced training where they're given a rest between, than to try to overload them. And you can kind of imagine how that might arise in a model like this, because, again, to learn something really well, you got to end up down here. Now, suppose that you potentiate a synapse and then you try to do it again and again and again and again. That's the way to get down here. So it makes sense to have repeated trials. But suppose that these transitions, not only being less likely, take more time. And that's reasonable because we imagine that as you go down this cascade, you're making more and more dramatic changes in the synapse. Here you might just be doing some phosphorylation. Down here you might be making a whole structural change in the spine head, for example, or even sprouting new spines. So if these transitions take time, then it's stupid to try to induce, let's say, the transition from 4 to 5 when you're still up in 3. You've got to wait till you get there and then induce the transition. And in fact, by incorporating those delays, we can get, this is work done with Alex Ramirez, a graduate student in Columbia, we can get a kind of interesting effect that's in the learning literature of people, which is that, I'll just do this quickly, but the idea is that there's an optimal spacing. So this axis is the spacing between the two trials of training that are in this experiment. And these different colors corresponding to testing the people at different intervals. And the upshot of this and in the data and in the model is that if you test people quickly, they do best if you mass the training trials. But if you test them long after, you should space out the trials, and the longer you're going to wait before you test them, the longer you should wait between the trials. So that's the kind of effect you get here. Okay, so the other thing that you might think about in this model is a sort of reinforcement learning idea where you work your way down here by reward. So perhaps reward induces these transitions. And it allows you to sort of gradually learn something that's repeatedly rewarded. So that's the idea. I think there's a great challenge here. This is just scratching the surface of a huge topic. But I think that getting multiple timescales into our thinking about these neural circuits and their physiology is going to be a crucial step. Okay, I'll stop there.
For some questions, I think we couldn't have asked for a more dynamics of learning talk, I think, to get our center started. So any questions? Yes.
In your first example, you had decay to baseline, but did that require that the decay to baseline of actual firing rate is infinite?
Yeah, I mean, those were an exponential. We think of it more as power law, but no. I mean, obviously, once it goes to zero, you're not going to get the effect anymore. So it's got to just be very slowly decaying. The shape of it doesn't really matter.
So you told the story at the beginning and playfully misremembered.
Yeah.
Right. And we know this happens. False memories. How could that possibly happen in your
family? Right. So this is actually, I'm really glad you said that because I did that on purpose, just so somebody smart like you would figure out. And that is, I think we shouldn't forget. So let me go back. I guess there's a faster way to go back, but we'll get there. To the Terry slide. There we go. Okay. So the kinds of models that I was talking about, they get to about this level. And then they stop. And, to get to the kind of thing where 50 years later, the younger people, I won't make the memory 50 years from now, but some of you will, it takes something else. Then I don't understand what that is. But a part of that is that we invent it, right? And sometimes we're right. In other words, we don't need very much data to recreate the event. And we use our experience of the world to say, well, Terry must have been sitting down because people sit down at talks. I don't have to remember that you were sitting down and things like that. But, of course, as a result, we also screw up. And I think that in really long-term memory, it's hard to check, but people aren't really nearly as good as they think they are, and as I wasn't in this little toy example.
So in a behaving animal, stimuli to drive neurons come in a constant flow.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the neuron doesn't respond to a stimulus and then slowly adapt to it or responds to something else a second later. So I wonder if you've thought about another learning process or another phenomenon.
Yeah, so you raised, I mean, yeah, okay. So he was raising a very, very good point that I was guilty of, and really almost all computational neuroscience is guilty of, is that we like to think of an experiment as present a stimulus like a slide on a screen, wait a little while, generate a response. And although many experiments try to work that way, that isn't life. Life is continual flow. I'm just going to repeat your question. I don't have anything intelligent to say about it, but that is another huge challenge to embed, you know, relevant stimuli in this continuous flow and then get these systems to respond. It's a great point.
Question in front. So just with your multi-scale model, I think you mentioned that is embedded in the pharmacology of the synapse. In other words, once some sort of chemical process is set up at one time scale, then there's some likelihood that will trigger another chemical process which will operate over a longer period of time.
Exactly right. So he's remarking on sort of what's the physiology and molecular biology behind this state diagram. We don't know, but I mean, that would be the goal, would be to find the true state diagram for a synapse, and in addition be able to say this transition is phosphorylation, this is, you know, expression of new proteins or something like this, that all of those would correspond to some kind of molecular biology processes. But we don't know exactly what they are right now.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to now introduce our second speaker, Kobena Boahan from Stanford University. And Kobena was, I believe, an undergraduate at Johns Hopkins just after I left. I was at Hopkins in the mid-80s. And when I arrived, I was a new faculty in the Department of Biophysics, and I was really interested in computation in the nervous system, so I thought I'd have a graduate seminar on the biophysics of computation. I had no idea what it was going to be about, but I thought it would be fun to think about that. How is it that neurons compute, and what are the physical processes that might be going on? And someone showed up at that first seminar who was from electrical engineering, and he turned out to be a real fireball. His name was Andreas Andreo from the electrical engineering department. And he was, little did I know, that he was actually listening to the lectures and discussions and arguing and going back to the electrical engineering department in the basement and building these devices with analog VLSI technology, which at the time was extremely new. It had just been invented by Carver Mead at Caltech. Well, Kwabena left Hopkins and became a graduate student at Caltech with Carver Mead, where I got to know him much better, and has since then gone on first to the University of Pennsylvania and most recently to Stanford University. And I should mention that he is the second speaker on this podium who won an NIH Pioneer Award, very prestigious, very difficult award to win because there's so many people who, and it's given for people who are doing innovative research, $500,000 a year for 5 years. Is that right? Okay, so there are two people on this that were on this podium, have been on this podium, and I'm not one of them. So Larry was a winner in the first year, and Kwabena is the most recent winner. So Kwabena.
Thanks a lot, Terry, and thanks for the invitation. And I'm still trying to get it up to 20 million, but we'll see. But that's really been fantastic that happened. And what I'm going to talk about is actually the proposal that what I propose to do with this Pioneer Award, which is to develop a system which will allow us to basically simulate the cortex at a scale that is not possible even with the fastest supercomputers that we have right now. And furthermore, we want to make this affordable so that you don't need a special supercomputing center. You can have one of these machines on your desk. And so I'm going to tell you basically why I think this approach is going to work and why this is the right time to do it. Terry already alluded to that, in that we are basically, it's going to happen once and it's going to happen in our lifetime, and we're going to figure out how the brain works. We're not going to leave that for our grandchildren. And so And the reason why we have this opportunity now is because we are acquiring data at an unprecedented rate. We've got this technique called patch clamping recordings in the dendrites that is revealing how neurons integrate the thousands of inputs that they receive. We've got serial scanning electron microscopes that are reconstructing, 50 nanometer resolution, the microcircuitry that these neurons are embedded in. And we've got these two photon calcium imaging microscopes that are mapping the behavior of individual cells in the cortex, the entire volume of cortex. And basically now all we have to do is to connect the dots. That is, we have to show how these computational primitives that we are discovering in the dendrites embedded in this microcircuitry that we are reconstructing give rise to the functional behavior that we are mapping. And the problem that we have is one of scale. I like people to show by hands. Who has seen this slide before? Yeah, Terry has a two-dimensional version of the slide, but actually I got this from Terry, and you saw the same slide in Larry's talk, but he used it in a more creative way. But it makes the point very nicely as to the problem that we have to tackle, which is that we have these seven levels of investigation, people looking at the system, different levels of the system, which don't overlap in the way that we are investigating them, and this spans 10 orders of magnitude in scale. And there are basically three ways in which you can tackle this complexity. The first approach is to sort of dissect it experimentally, which is where these levels of investigation come from, right? People are working on ion channels, people are working on mapping, orientation maps and cortex and so on. The problem with that is that you basically separate these different parts. You don't get an integrated view of the system, and you lose track of how, like Larry was pointing out, we don't know how these cascades map onto the actual biophysics or biomolecular biology that's going on in there. The second option is to analyze it theoretically, and Larry showed really beautiful, some of them was beautiful work in that respect, thinking about it in an abstract way. But again, it's very tough, and because you've got things that are stochastic, you've got heterogeneous behavior, you've got nonlinear recurrent networks, and so on. And so, then we get into these debates as to, which assumptions are correct and which ones are valid, and so on. And the third option is to simulate directly. Okay, this is something that will allow you, if you have basically a computer that's powerful enough, to include all the details which will complement your theory, and also to control all the parameters which will complement your experiments. The problem is that the fastest supercomputers we have are not up to the task of actually dealing with this kind of scale. Okay, so imagine that we wanted to actually simulate what's happening in the cortex during a typical visually guided task in the laboratory. We would start with our reconstruction, 3D reconstructions of pyramidal cells, and we would then compartmentalize that, divide it up into compartments, we'll populate each compartment with the ion channel repertoire that we have identified for those cells. These are modeled using the Hodgkin-Huxley formulation, so you've got a set of equations like that for each population that you have. And you'd code them in software, and you load that into the fastest computer in the world, which is BlueGene. And as a group in Stockholm, Lassner's group actually did this, where they ran a model with 8 million neurons connected with 4 billion synapses on one BlueGene rack, which is 2,048 processors. And just 1 second of activity, imagine the monkeys doing a 1 second trial, that took an hour and 20 minutes to simulate. So that's almost 5,000 times slower than real time. The reason why it was so slow was basically the computer had to perform close to 40 trillion computations. So even though a BlueGene rack is a 3 teraflop machine, it's really not up to the task of doing this. And the approach that I'm proposing is something that's completely different. In Terry's introduction, he mentioned that I got into this area when I was an undergrad, and the idea is to basically, instead of using the ion channel, these equations to model what an ion channel is doing, you can emulate the current that's going across a population of ion channels directly with the current that's going across the channel of a transistor. Okay. And so this approach is called analog VLSI, and it was pioneered by Kavamid in the late 80s. And with this approach, basically, you get a system that will run in real time, and so 1 second trial will take 1 second to simulate. So before I tell you how we actually do this, we use transistors to directly emulate how ion channels work. I just want you to know how we represent a transistor in a circuit, which is we use this little symbol here, and those are the different terminals of the transistor. So you're going to see that in the next slide. And so the reason why we are able to do this is that there's actually a real direct physical analogy between the way a transistor works and the way in which an ion channel works, or the gating mechanism of an ion channel. And so people typically represent that by plotting this energy diagram for the reaction. So in this state, the ion channel is closed, and then it opens. And the idea is how to overcome some get some activation energy, or overcome a barrier to get into the open state. We actually think of transistors in exactly the same way. Electrons are sitting here at the source terminal of the device. They have to get over to the drain terminal of the device. And to do that, they have to get a certain amount of energy to overcome this barrier to get into the channel. That's how we control the flow across the transistor. And so it's not just that these, you know, diagrams look alike. There's a quantitative, actually, analogy there in that this, because of thermodynamics, these gating particles and electrons both overcome the energy barriers at a rate that's exponential in the barrier height. So as you reduce these barriers in the ion channel, if it's a voltage-dependent ion channel, then those barriers will be modulated by the voltage across the membrane. And in the transistor, we use the voltage on the gate to modulate this barrier. As we reduce that barrier, the current or the flux of these particles increases exponentially. Okay. And because of that, basically, we got this insight, or we basically figured this out about 3-4 years ago. And by basically then pushing this analogy further, we were able to actually, all we have to do is to model the ion channel dynamics is to just modulate the height of the barrier in the transistor the same way in which the membrane voltage of a transistor modulates the barrier in the ion channels for the ion channels gating pattern. So I'll show you the results that we got first. I have to explain to you what we are trying to model. So this is how ion channels behave. What you do, the way you characterize their behavior, is that you take your neuron and you patch clamp it, and you step the voltage, this is called voltage clamp, to different levels. And this is a voltage-dependent ion channel. And you watch the current that flows across the ion channels. Okay, there's a small population of them. And as you step it to higher and higher voltage levels, you get more and more currents. And this is characterized by the steady state level. When you wait long enough, how much current do you get, which reflects the fraction of channels that are open, and the time constant, how long it takes to get to that steady state level. And so then if you actually then plot that out, the dependence of the steady state level on the membrane voltage is sigmoid. And the dependence of the time constant, these how fast it approaches steady state, is bell-shaped. And this is sigmoid and bell-shaped. This is the way in which the Hodgkin-Huxley model is parameterized. It's parameterized to determine, you know, where these sigmoids kick on and where these bell curves are centered and so on. It's just these shapes are sort of built into the Hodgkin-Huxley model. And you just change those parameters. And so with this 3-transistor circuit here, we tried for a while to do it with 1 transistor, like I showed you in the analogy before. It turned out that with 1 transistor, we couldn't actually control the opening rates and the closing rates independently. So we needed 2. With this transistor here, with the VO, sets the opening rates, the rate at which channels are transitioning from closed to open. And this one sets the closing rate, the rate at which they transition back. But then with this circuit, and then this one here changes that fraction into a current that reflects the current that will flow across that population, and that's what we are plotting here. And with the same kind of voltage clamp experiment with the circuit, you get curves that look like that, and when you plot the steady state level versus the membrane voltage you step it to, you get a sigmoid and you get a bell-shaped time constant. Now, this is actually really great because this is a very compact circuit to do this, and in fact, even if you didn't care about the biology or care about Hodgkin-Huxley or anything like that, this is simpler than implementing a resistor. in a chip, okay? Because transistors have this exponential nonlinearity, and so people work really hard to get rid of it, and it takes a bunch of transistors, a lot of tricks to do that, okay? But so they naturally give you this for free, essentially. And so what I said at the beginning is that I want to actually build a computer out of these devices, and so you should be able to program, you know, the different kinds of activation energies and time constants based on the particular ion channel population that you're trying to model. And you can do this in this circuit by simply changing the voltages that you apply here and there. You can shift the sigmoid, and you can shift the bell curve around and change its height. And so you can model things that activate at low voltages or high voltages and channels that activate quickly or slowly. And then by interchanging these two voltage levels, like making this one higher and that one lower, you know, reversing that, you can make a channel that inactivates rather than activates. Okay, so we've got that full degree of programmability in this device. And then the next thing I said is I want to make this affordable. I want to have, you know, this on my desk or on your desk to do these, to implement your models, and to convince you that it will be affordable to do this, I have to tell you about the inspiration for this project. And so the inspiration from this project comes from Jun Makino, who is this astrophysicist at the University of Tokyo who built this supercomputer here that physicists use to simulate how galaxies collide. Okay. And so what they are trying to do is they're trying to figure out, this is a picture from Hubble, and but these are two galaxies that are coming together, and you're trying to figure out basically what's going to happen, right? Whether we're going to be around, you know, millions of years from now, right? And so these things are coming together. There's gravity between these stars is pulling them together. And they make this point mass approximation and represent each star in each galaxy by a point mass. And then they have to compute the law of gravity between all the possible pairings, right? And they basically then, what Jun did was he basically just hardwired the law of gravity into these chips. So they do it directly in the hardware. They're very efficient at doing this. And 32 of these chips can fit on a little thing like your desk. That's just the size of your desktop computer. And this machine is a third as fast as a BlueJeans rack. So it's actually a teraflop machine. In fact, his machines were the first to break the teraflop barrier. Okay. And whereas this, but then it's 16 times more cost effective. This is 42K for one of these 1 teraflop machines. And a 3 teraflop BlueJeans rack will cost you $2 million. Okay. And so there's maybe about 20 or 2 dozen labs in the world now who use these machines, and they can simulate galaxies with up to like 1 million stars in them. And you are doing 1 million times 1 million interactions, right? Because gravity goes everywhere. So that's 10 to the 12 interactions. And they've actually done some new, you know, made some discoveries with this. These simulations were the first to show something called gravothermal oscillations, where, like I said, gravity is pulling these stars together. But as they get closer and closer in, you start getting more and more collisions, and the collisions or the thermal kind of heating tends to then expand the galaxies apart, and you get these oscillations where it contracts and expands. And so this is sort of the inspiration for our project, is that we have a similar scale of problem. We've got 10 to the 12 neurons in the brain, and we've got these interactions, although they are happening between, you know, specific neurons and sparse connectivity. On the other hand, it's mediated by spikes, which are very fast events, whereas gravity, you know, is a continuous, slowly evolving thing. And so, but the inspiration nonetheless stands that we can actually start thinking about, with the project that we are building, developing a customized or specialized hardware platform to do this. But unlike June's machine, which is still digital, even though it's a special purpose, we are going to use this analog emulation, which directly emulates what's happening with ion channels with transistors. And the thing is, even though we've gone through 40 years of rapid improvements, very basically orders of magnitude improvements in computing speed, Intel canceled the 4 gigahertz Pentium in 2004, and now they are trying to convince you that you don't really need a 6 gigahertz machine, right? They're telling you that you need a dual or a quad or something like that, right? Because it's getting more and more difficult to get more performance, even though we are still shrinking transistors and putting more of them in a chip. The wiring delays and the overheating is preventing us from increasing the clock speed. And so this is in the analog approach, we don't rely on speed, we rely on parallelism like the brain does, right? And this is a quote that actually makes the point very nicely from Scott Watson. He's a reporter, the Tech Reporter. It's this online website where you can read whether you should get an AMD or you should get Intel. And he says, when guarding Moore's goose lays a golden egg and the number of transistors possible on a chip doubles, as it is supposed to do every 18 months, this is Moore's law, right? Taking advantage of the windfall has proven increasingly difficult, okay? Because they're trying to get it to run faster and the delays and the heat dissipation is killing them. What we are saying is that if you can fit twice as many transistors on a chip, then just build twice as many ion channels and use them to build twice as many silicon neurons and get a twice bigger network. And that's just as simple to do. It's not, you know, complicated. Okay? And so that's sort of the analog approach. And we've demonstrated this in the sort of this system here, which is a multi-chip model of primary visual cortex. And so what this is every board on here has a chip that's called a Gabor chip. And the chip has on it, you know, these are the chips, this is a chip we designed as a custom VLSI chip. Has on it a 32 by 64 array of neurons, and they're using transistors directly to emulate the sort of currents that are flowing across the membranes of neurons and so forth, and generating spikes. So there's four types at each location in the array, with even and odd phase and on and off contrast. And it has programmable orientation tuning, so you can take four copies of this chip and you can distribute the image from a silicon retina to all those chips, and you can tune them up electronically or program them to be oriented vertically, 45, horizontal, and so on, in even or odd phases. And together, then, this does what's happening in a hypercolumn, an orientation hypercolumn in the cortex. And this system is basically was used to sort of demonstrate that we can scale up these neuromorphic systems up to 30,000 neurons. And the next step we want to take is to go to a million by scaling up, building these sort of multi-chip systems. And so a machine that we are proposing to build in 2 years is called NeuroGrid. And it'll be based on a 2D grid of chips, which will sit on the same board, unlike that 1D grid on separate boards that you saw. There'll be programmable connections between the chips, and you then use one chip to model each cell type or cell layer you have in the cortex, and you can model several cortical regions in this way as well. And the way in which we program the connections, I've told you how we model ion channels, the way we do the program the connections is that this chip has an array of neurons on it. It's connected. To connect them to the next chip, which has an array of neurons on it as well, we can fit thousands of neurons on a chip, but we can't run 1,000 wires between the two chips. Chips typically only have about 100 wires. And so what we do, and we've been doing this, for 10, 12 years already, to build an optic nerve or something like that, is to assign each neuron an address and each synapse on that target chip an address as well. And then when this neuron spikes, its address comes off the chip. So for 1,000 neurons, you would only need 10 bits or 10 wires to send that address. And you can go up to, 100,000 or whatever easily. It's a logarithmic thing, which is a constant, according to the theorist in the audience, a constant amount of wires. And so this is a good strategy. And so that's each neuron has an address, and each synapse on that target chip has an address. So when we present that address, a postsynaptic potential will be generated at this synapse. And it could be inhibitory or excitatory, depending on what type of synapse we put on the chip. And then what we do is we simply intersperse a RAM, which is a lookup table, between the two chips, so that when we get spike neuron number two spikes, we then translate that to synapse address number two, and then that gives us a direct connection here. Or address number one could be translated to three, and that's a connection there. And so then by just downloading whatever connectivity table you want into that RAM, you can change the connectivity. And you can even have the chip itself update the RAM and change the wiring itself so you can have an atomic plasticity. But that's a separate chip, a different chip that we built. And so that's the board, the way in which you program the connections. And then the chips themselves we call NeuroCore. And each one is going to have an array of neurons on it with these, Hodgkin-Huxley ion channel models that I described. And so NeuroGrid will have an array of 4x4 chips, 256 by 256 neurons each. That gets you up to a million neurons. And if you calculate, if you're able to run a million neurons in real time, like 1 second takes you 1 second to simulate, it will take you a computer that's 280 times more powerful than GRIP or a 280 teraflop machine to do that. So that would be the equivalent performance of the first version of NeuroGRIP that we're going to build. And then in 5 years, just by going to more advanced technology, we can scale it up. And so I just want to say a little bit about the details about how actually this is actually implemented. I said it's going to be a 2D array of neurons on a chip, and that would be used to model a layer of the cortex. And then you could have several copies of the same chips, these neural core chips, model the different layers in that cortical area of different cell types. And you can also have multiple cortical areas. And then the way in which you program the connections, I said you use the RAM. And we have two kinds of RAM, on-chip RAM and off-chip RAM. And they are used differently. And then we have a mesh, which is also another connection fabric. And so the way it works is the on-chip RAM is used to program the vertical connection. So they built into this, the design of this computer is this idea of a columnar microsecond, right? So this is sort of the way in which people think about how cortex works, that there's stereotyped connections within a column vertically, and the different cell layers interact in a stereotyped way. You just replicate that in all the columns. And so in order to do that, really, first, because it's the same, it's a very small lookup table for all the neurons, and so you can store that on the chip, and by putting that on the chip, you can implement this connectivity really fast, very efficiently. And so that's sort of built in here, and then when you wanted to have off-chip RAM is used, then if you want to have these sort of long-range horizontal connections that go from some arbitrary column to some other arbitrary column, then you could program that connectivity here off-chip. It's a little bit slower, less efficient, but then a lot of the connectivity in the cortex is local, and there are fewer of these long-range connections. And then the last thing is this resistive mesh. So built into the architecture is this idea that of an axonal arbor. That is, if you target a particular column, you get into that column. You don't just connect to that column, you connect to neighboring columns as well, because cortex is organized in this topographic fashion so that, for example, in V1, cells have similar orientation tuning, so they have similar overlapping, similarly wide receptive fields. And so we take advantage of that to get an additional fan out locally within the chip just by spreading it from neighbor to neighbor with this mesh. And so with that, we can build something that can connect one neuron to 6,000 others. And so you could have a million neurons with on the other 6 billion connections. And so that's the architecture. And so far what we've developed, I told you we've implemented and demonstrated the ion channel modeling Hodgkin-Huxley dynamics. We also implemented and demonstrated this on-chip SRAM that we can use to program the columnar microsecond. And so this is just a chip that had a was built that worked and did that. And so the idea now is that as this is a 1D version, but we want to go to 2D grids, but these are your neural core chips. And what you want to do is you want to have, let's say, your layer 5 guys on here, your layer 2-3 guys, and maybe layer 4 or inhibitory guys, and so on and so forth. And you want a spike coming from a particular layer to excite these two guys, but not that guy. And in this particular column, maybe hit an inhibitory interneuron, and here hit an excitatory guy, so there are different types of neurons at each location in the array. And so all you do is this on-chip RAM, and there's a lookup table that then, based on which chip it came from, which determines which cell type or which layer of cortex it is, then map either filters that spike, doesn't send it into the array, or directs it, appends some bits that say it should hit this guy or that guy, and so on. And so this is something we demonstrated that it works fine. And then the last piece of the puzzle then is actually what abstraction do you actually use for the pyramidal cells or the neurons themselves, okay? And this is something that, you know, there's ongoing debate about. But the idea is that you've got these pyramidal cells. It's one of the important functions you want to capture here is the fact that the pyramidal cells themselves are the elements that integrate information across different layers of the cortex. Okay, so they have this elongated structure where they have this apical dendritic tuft that sits up in the upper layers, and they have this basal dendritic tree that sits down in the lower layers. And you have interactions between inputs that come in. Basically, as shown here, the layering is important because you've got these different types of connections, feed forward, feed backward from higher level of cortex back to lower levels of cortex, and lateral interactions all originate from and target specific layers in the cortex. And so they end up in different layers and then they then interact. So this feedback may be coming up here and then feed forward input may be coming down here, and those things interact. And recent work by Lucia et al. Have shown that actually these things interact in a nonlinear way, where basal input apical input coming up here can change the gain to basal input coming in down there, so the feedback can modulate the feed-forward pathway. And they've reproduced this type of nonlinear interaction in a two-compartment model. And it depends on this backpropagating action potentials and active channels in the apical dendrites. And this model is my favorite right now for the way to sort of use a neurogrid, because just two compartments then allows me to have the maximum number of neurons, and you can trade number of compartments per neuron for total number of neurons in your chip. But we also have the option of designing the chip in such a way that instead of thinking of these individual blocks as neurons, you think of them as compartments, and you can group them together any way you want. So you can then make that trade-off after you fabricate the chip. And so this is this is sort of the simplest model here, which can integrate information from different layers of the cortex, which is the basic functionality that you need. And just to show you in terms of real data, we've used this Hodgkin-Huxley model. I showed you that we get the bell shape, time constant, and the sigmoid activation. We also used it to model then a real population of ion channels, this T-type calcium channel, which inactivates and activates. And so you need to have the product of these two states determines the fraction of channels that are open. And we can use two of our circuits to model, one to model activation, one to model inactivation. And a simple two-transistor circuit to basically take the product. And with that, we're able to reproduce recordings from the silicon neuron. And this is recordings from a thalamic relay cell, which are these cells, together with a lot of other cells in the cortex and other areas that have these T-type calcium channels. And what the T-type calcium channel does, it makes the cell burst, but you have to hyperpolarize the cell first so that you can de-inactivate it. So you're up here probably one with your inactivation. And then you depolarize it quickly, and this thing takes time to inactivation to kick in, and so you can get up here, and then you can fire a burst of spikes. You can activate the channel, get a lot of current. And then the inactivation will shut it off. And so, but if you start from a depolarized state here, you just get tonic firing like a regular neuron, like you see here. And so we can reproduce both the tonic firing and the bursting in the silicon model. And to give you an idea of how compact these ion channel models are, is you have 3,000 of those relay cells on a 10 square millimeter chip here, which is where we got this data from. And so the other thing that's nice about the two-compartment model is this is actually work from Terry's lab, now 10 years ago now, by Zach Manning, is that they showed that this two-compartment model can also reproduce the different types of firing behavior that you find in these different types of cortical cells. So it's also got this versatility. In addition to this nonlinear interaction between the two compartments, you can actually just tweak it to get different types of behavior. And so the way they demonstrated this was that they basically started with your full 3D reconstruction of your pyramidal cell, hundreds of compartments, with all the different ion channels in there spread uniformly throughout the cells. And then all they did was change the morphology. So you reconstruct this guy, you populate him the same way as you populated that guy, and you get these different firing patterns. So they showed that it was really morphology that was determining the behavior. And then they went further, and then they were able to reduce that to a two-compartment model, just having a dendritic compartment and a soma compartment. And these two parameters, basically the capacitances, and basically how big your dendritic tree was when it was captured by the capacitance, and how strong your coupling was, which was captured by this resistance, and they were able to then, by tuning those parameters, replicate that those different firing patterns. So again, the two-compartment model has this flexibility that you can then use it to model different cell types. So that's another reason why I'm voting for two compartments. So the last couple of slides here is a little bit about the kind of science that we want to do with this. I don't just want to build it, I want to actually use it myself to figure out, you know, the kinds of things that we've been talking about. And the capability that we're going to have is be able to build these multi-area cortical models. So you won't just have one area of the cortex and the various layers, you'll actually be able to build models that are large scale enough to have multiple layers talking to each other. And the reason why this is interesting is that, as you know, the visual cortex alone has maybe some like 30 cortical areas in it. Okay, and that's just the visual cortex. And so there's this sort of outstanding question as to, you know, it appears that we are taking our perception and we are just compartmentalizing, we're dividing it into all these maps, we're creating all these representations and so on and so forth. And yet we experience the world as this coherent percept, right? Somehow this starts to come all back together again. And, you know, maybe this is why everything is talking to everything else. I mean, we don't really know what those feedback connections are doing. They are about half the number of connections in the cortex, these feedback connections. And so that's the question we'd like to look at with these models. And we'd like to start by just studying one instance of that, which is the feedback between MT and V1. And we know a lot about the physiology and anatomy of these two areas, but we haven't been able to put all that information in a model that can bridge that scale from, you know, all this physiological detail up to the scale of visual, where you can do visual tasks and things like that with the model. And so this is sort of this is what we would like to look at. And our present understanding of the way in which we think, briefly, the way that we think how MT works is that basically MT is thought to basically determine the motion of objects. That's how you perceive motion. And the idea is that this starts in V1, where you perceive the parts, how the various parts in the scene are moving, and then MT sort of then integrates it into this motion for the actual object. And this is sort of a feed-forward way of thinking about it. And yet, like I said here, we've got a lot of feedback that's happening, and in particular, there is feedback between MT and V1. And so our hypothesis is that this feedback is actually playing a role in doing this computation and in integrating the information so that you can get this coherent perception of an object's motion. And also, when you generalize that to an entire cortex, what's happening is that all these different cues that are being computed are constantly talking to each other, and you are constantly seeking consistency between all these things. This is something that my computer scientist colleagues call composition. It's a compositional solution to the problem. And there's you know, arguments that they've come up with from trying to solve the vision problem that convinces them that you really need something like this to be able to solve it. And so that would be what we would like to tackle with NeuroGrid, and we'll be doing this in collaboration with Bill Newsom, who's at Stanford and studies area MT. And so here is basically, to summarize, we've basically demonstrated already three technologies that we can use to build NeuroGrid. And the first one is the grid network for expandability. So we can just keep adding chips and we can have more and more layers and more complex models. The digital VLSI for programmability, so that we can basically program any kind of connection pattern that we want. And the analog VLSI for very compact evaluation of this Hodgkin-Huxley-like channel dynamics and getting rid of all those equations so you can do this in real time. And so with these technologies in hand, our goal is to actually put supercomputers that you can actually afford to buy on your desk that can do real-time cortex-scale simulations within 5 years. And so I would like to just acknowledge and point out the people who did contributed to this, these technologies, developing these technologies. Paul Meroller, who's right there. Where's Paul? This is the Find Wilder task there. This is Paul. Joseph Lin, who's over on that side. That's Joseph. And Kai Hanner back in here someplace. Okay, this is Kai. So those three guys actually, you know, Kai did the Hodgkin-Huxley dynamics work and figured out how to do that with transistors. Joseph implemented the on-chip SRAM to add the programmability to these grid networks. And Paul developed the communication for the grid grid network. And we did this, the Gabor chip system was built in collaboration with Bert Chi, who is at HKUSD, and Rajit Monaha supplied the asynchronous SRAM. All the digital stuff is asynchronous in our designs. And to find out more about what we've been doing, there was a cover story that I wrote in, appeared in May 2005 about these neuromorphic chips. So a good place to learn more if you're interested. Thank you.
So we have time for some questions, and I'm going to start by asking, because this is a multi-level workshop, and you've already shown us that you're going from the single neuron, the dendrite, up to the network level. Does your chip have an EEG?
I mean, we have to measure it and see whether it has it, but... Am I understand? You know, the way I'd imagine that, you're seeing EEG is basically when you look at the activity summed over populations of neurons, you tend to see these rhythms, and they show us as peaks in the spectrum if you take an FFT. And I think that they are signatures of different time constants or cycle times at which inhibition works in different circuits are cycling. And so that should emerge if we have this feedback and all this stuff working correctly. That should emerge from these chips.
But so perhaps you could measure that and send your data to Scott McCaig, and he'll tell you what the chips are thinking. Okay. Well, any other questions? This one, and let's take one in the red. Well, Pascal.
That?
Yeah.
So one of the big success stories is that it's also to kind of simplify the system. So, for example, if you take an ion channel, you don't today simulate or model all the atoms in it, but you just write down the formula, and that's it. Now, and that's what you're actually using in your code.
Right.
So, with your model, do you not want to basically simulate the entire brain in a flat fashion, such that you model every ion channel in every neuron? Or are you just trying to basically understand how a column works and then derive from that the simplified model of the column, such that then in the next step you can actually go and plug together an entire brain out of those column models?
It's sort of like two questions in one, but basically the question is that what is the right level of abstraction in a nutshell? Because why do we stop, instead of modeling all the individual atoms in an ion channel, why do we stop by just capturing its behavior at the population level, for example? Okay? And so, what's the right level of abstraction, if I may rephrase it that way? And this is why, what I'm trying to do is not abstract. I'm trying to do a simulation, and I think of simulation as sort of the third leg of the stool. So you've got experiment and you've got theory. A lot of people think of simulation as sort of theory, but actually these astrophysicists have actually, set up a whole different field where these people are doing these computational experiments and analyzing their computational data, and they feed into the theorists and the experiments. It's a separate arm. And the reason why it's separate is that it complements those two things. You see what I'm saying? So once you do theories, like you have to abstract all this complexity away to come with a simple thing. These simulations can help you figure out really, what's important, what are you missing from that, and so on and so forth, and can feed into those theories. And then experiment also, you can never actually record everything you're interested in or control the parameters you're interested in. Again, simulations can complement that. So I think that's an important distinction. Think of simulations as sort of a third approach, it complements, there's no conflict with sort of abstraction. And so the reason why we put in all this detail and we're actually trying to model in this flat way is that that's sort of the gold standard. This is what, biologists, if we do these kinds of simulations at this level of detail, they'll believe them, right? And that's why we pick this level of detail.
Jerry?
And that's sort of the standard of which we're doing.
Bo had a comment that leads to a question, as you well know. I'm a big fan, coming from my own background, of modeling something from the electronics, and I think building something with the basic theories are not quite there. You learn something. It's a great thing to do. On the other hand, the guys doing gravity work presumably have some phenomenological models that are tried and true. They were experiments that presumably, let's say, one understands better than one does understand the brain. So what you're doing is you're taking a brain that hasn't quite figured out and modeling it, which is the common. The question I had is that it would seem that what you're doing and what Henry's doing, Markram, Son, or whatever, using his blue brain, blue gene, seems very much based, and again, maybe I'm wrong, it's a question, on column structures, neocortical columns, perhaps mini columns, perhaps not alternatives that could be self-organizing and self-assemblies. Terry mentioned there could be a lot of ways that still aren't quite understood.
Yeah.
And I still think it's a good thing to do, so it's not the point.
Right.
The point
yeah.
is, would you comment on where you came from and after the audience that perhaps looks at different ways, knowing from the Milon learning curve that columns haven't quite been accepted as a way to go?
It's a good question. If I can repeat the question, I mean, in some sense, I mean, Jerry is saying that, you know, are we, you know, should we be trying to understand the brain from a self-organized or a developmental type of approach? You know, we are really taking very much a circuit-based or synaptic organization-based way of trying to understand it. And is this the right level? So it's not even abstraction. It's really kind of, you know, whether we are going to try to do Mendeleev's periodic table or we are going to do quantum mechanics to really figure out chemistry, right? I'm a firm believer that we want to actually understand it at the developmental level. And we've actually built chips like these self-organizing chips and so on and so forth that do that. And we started to flow in that pathway and we actually different types of mechanisms. And because I think that these developmental rules, you know, hide a lot of complexity. Okay, so there's a lot of complexity we're trying to explain when we look at the mature structure. And yet, if you look at the amount of information in your DNA, it's 100 million times less than the amount of information that it needs to describe that mature structure. So all this complexity is being generated by these developmental rules. And so just like how we can start with quantum mechanics and we can basically, in theory, run a chemical reaction, we're still mixing the stuff up in beakers to see what happens, right? And so, you know, but, and yeah, we feel like we understand chemistry, even though we can't predict from quantum mechanics, you know, directly what's going to happen, right? We don't run those simulations. I mean, that's too, yeah. So it's a question of having a simpler description of what's going on, and I think the developmental approach is the way to get at that simpler description. And even if you want to build technology, again, you face that complexity issue, and that will also make your technology more powerful. So, you know, but this is more of a simulation platform, a tool that people can use to test out their ideas. So if people have specific hypotheses about what the feedback is doing or how these layers are interacting and so on and so forth, they can test them out, and it can run really quickly, and they can get answers.
You'll learn a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
So
but that's
one of the features of Quabena's particular approach, which makes it different from Henry Markram's, is that it's going to be a real-time system. You're going to be able to interact with it. At the same time that you're sitting there, you could twist the knobs and see how it changes the equilibrium. And I think that it'll use your own sensory system, our ability to see things in our own and to on screen and to hear things in the same way that we can interact with a living a creature.
Right, when you do an experiment.
Yeah, and I think the intuition we're going to get is fantastic. As opposed to the big blue approach, which is you know a really brute force way to simulate anything, where you know if it takes a week to do a simulation, and this has happened to me. You know, you forget when you get the result back what you asked. In a week's time, you know, it's a whole lifetime for a researcher. So, it's you know, you may you not only forgotten what you asked, but it was probably, you know, you're onto a new question completely.
That would explain that.
Yes, Scott.
Another problem, opportunity, dilemma, excitement about neuroscience is that, of course, new models are generating new interest in taking new measurements, and there that's generating lots of new discoveries about the details of particular cortical circuitry, cortical cell types, diversity of cell types, their dynamics, and the properties of modulations of motility, you know, all sorts of non-stationarities in the in the real brain, as well as, of course, the static silicon brain. Mm-hmm. So you must have also thought about how to differentiate cell types to add neuromodulation and so on as you become either needing it in stimulation
Yeah, we haven't actually done the sort of neuromodulation or sort of the reinforcement. Okay, I'll repeat the question. I mean, I think you're talking about plasticity, basically, in general, and these changes that are going on and these neuromodulators that...
And differentiation.
Right, and this neurogrid doesn't include any plasticity, but we've looked at plasticity in other chips that we've implemented. We've implemented spike time and dependent plasticity. We've implemented anatomical plasticity like axonal pathfinding and rewiring topographic map formation in that way. And this is something I want to do in the next version. So this initial two-year goal, build the system I described in the next version, I want to put in some kind of plasticity and, you know, we haven't really decided yet. But to move more to trying to let the thing self-organize and then, yeah, but... Yeah.
So
time
for one more question. Dan?
So it occurs to me that even if the chip doesn't get the brain exactly right, then it would still be a phenomenal prosthetic. So if you use it as a prosthetic, how would you get this to the much power?
Yeah, okay, so the that's something also... Okay, I'll repeat the question. The question is that even if we're able to do this and we don't get the brain right, we'll be able to use this as a prosthesis. And we've thought about that. The same, you know, property of the technology that allows us to basically compute with blue gene, this system with these 16 chips is going to dissipate about 1 watt of power, okay? Whereas a blue gene rack is something like 20 kilowatts, okay? And so with 1 watt of power, it's possible to sort of implant these kinds of devices, or actually to wear them. And so that's sort of definitely going to feed into or enable these sort of prosthetic devices. We like to work at the level where we're actually pushing the efficiency, right? Because if we are developing more efficient computing platforms, it will serve both the simulation side and the prosthetic side. So we don't directly work on prosthesis, but we by doing this, we're enabling those kinds of technologies, and other people are actually looking at that. Yeah.
So for those of you who don't know, in that picture, you'll see that there's an eye, and behind the eye there is a silicon chip. And in fact, Quabena's earlier work was to create very realistic, detailed models of retinas. But in fact, there are several companies now that have actually implanted chips like the ones that Quabena has built into human eyes. And there are humans walking around with not too good resolution, but at least they actually are being able to use their visual sight again, you know, who have intact ganglion cells and just you interface the silicon with the neuron. So it's really a technology that's really around the corner.
Well, thanks, Terry.
Okay. Okay, let's thank the speaker. And.